Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Adam Gopnik, whose latest book is Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. Earlier books, Through the Children's Gate, Paris to the Moon, and a novel for young people, The King in the Window. Adam Gopnik is a... Are you on staff of The New Yorker?
I am indeed. I'm a staff writer.
So you get a salary from
them. I get a salary.
Adam Gopnik, this book, Angels and Ages, is a book-length essay, and it's drawn, in a sense, from two pieces you wrote for The New Yorker, one published in May of 2007 on Lincoln, and then one a year earlier, 8 months earlier, in October 2006 on Darwin. Before we go into the reasons how you were drawn to each separately, at what point did you realize that the connection might be greater than the fact that they were both born February 12th, 1809?
Like everything we do in life, it was affected by the time that I was doing it. This was at one of the low points of the many low points that we've lived through in the last 8 years. And I wanted to write first about Darwin because I'd always loved Darwin as a writer. And naturally, I wanted, in a sense, because it was a time, if you recall, when the Dover drive to push evolution out of schools and so on was going in. And I wanted to write about Darwin as a kind of humanist, but not a humanist, Richard, in the sense of a nice guy, but somebody who in his scientific work had a vision of the world that was more complex and also more complexly presented, written, better written in plain English, than people knew. So I loved Darwin as a writer, and I wrote that essay about Darwin as a writer. And then the Lincoln thing sort of fell into my lap a couple of months later, because I got interested, and we can talk about it, this little dispute about his epitaph. Was it now he belongs to the angels or now he belongs to the ages? And I started that essay, and I realized that that essay as well was about the language of liberalism. They were both about the same thing. Liberalism not in the narrow sense of guys who vote for Democrats, but in the broad sense of democratic, scientific, rational, open societies. So I realized I had a subject there, and I don't honestly remember. It's a funny kind of amnesia. I don't remember when somebody pointed out to me or when I discovered that they were born on the same day. And at that moment, a kind of penny dropped, and I said, that might make an interesting little book. As you say, it's an essay. It's certainly a book, but it's a book that takes the form of an essay. And I thought I could write a kind of meditation about the relationship between science and liberalism, the language of liberalism, the eloquence of explanation, and so on, in the form of a commemorative book for this bicentenary. So that, in torturous form, is how this all happened.
As I was reading the book and then afterward reading a recent review in the Washington Post, mm-hmm. You know, the question is, how can you successfully draw them together and create a unity out of essentially two separate stories of an American politician and a naturalist in England? You know, I found the idea of the eloquence of explanation to be, to me, what stood out most. When you talk about that, what exactly do you mean by that?
I mean by it a couple of things. One is that both Darwin and Lincoln, and the book, I should add, isn't meant in any sense to be a comparison of these two men. It's not sort of parallel lives. He did this then, and then he did the same kind of thing elsewhere. As I say in the book, it's not about what they have in common with each other, but what they have in common with us, what the legacy of liberalism and of their language is for our lives. I think that one of the things that began in their time, in which they both exemplify, they didn't invent, is the idea that not only is it important to have good ideas, not only is it important to think in new and radical ways about the history of life on Earth or the nature of slavery, but it's important to share those ideas. It's important to make them available to a large public. You know, one of the things that makes Darwin such an extraordinary figure is that when he published On the Origin of Species in 1859, he didn't publish it as a scientific paper. He published it as a popular book, and it was published by a London publisher on the same list with books like mine and novels and biographies and so on. And it was meant to be read by any decently educated and curious person. And that's what makes it such a great book. If you start reading it, it's not a book that delivers authority from on high. It's a book that coaxes you to buy into an argument you might not really want to take part in. And it does it by way of saying to you, not, I have specialized esoteric knowledge that you don't. It says, listen, think about your own experience with dogs, with pigeons. Think about how they get bred. And then extend your imagination to think about what might happen if we had an almost infinite length of time and we had some mechanism in the world that would allow the same kind of selection to take place. Lincoln, of course, is a politician. He's someone who has to communicate very complicated ideas about the nature of this country, about the future of this country, about slavery and secession, and he has to do it to a vast popular audience. He's running for office. And the impressive thing about Lincoln, and I think easily overlooked thing about Lincoln, is that he makes very complicated arguments. He doesn't just exhort. He doesn't just inspire. He doesn't just move us. He has a complicated case to make in all of his great speeches, subtler usually than we remember, or than we often know, and he makes his case. He puts his case forward. So in that sense, that idea of the eloquence of explanation, the idea that it isn't only important to have a good idea, but it's important to articulate that idea to as many people as you can, that seems to me central to the best side of the tradition we call liberalism.
The story of how you got involved with Lincoln first, you were on a plane?
I was flying. I can't recall. I think it was when Through the Children's Gate was published in 2006, and I was flying out to California, and I read Doris Godwin's book, Team of Rivals, on the plane over. A good book, though I think wrong about certain things. I come to the end of it, and there, of course, is the famous epitaph. Edmund Stanton says, now he belongs to the ages, which I remembered from my own childhood, and it's a heart-wringing epitaph, great piece of American neoclassical rhetoric. And then on the plane back to New York, I was reading, because I'd gotten into a kind of Lincoln fixation, I was reading Carl Swanson's entertaining book about the search for John Wilkes Booth after the assassination. Well, Swanson has the death scene, and he has Stanton say, now he belongs to the angels. Puts it in there blandly, and I immediately turn to the back of the book and look for the footnote, and sure enough, he has an explanatory footnote saying that's not how it's usually accounted, but there are reasons to believe that it's right. So I sort of set out with a magnifying glass and a deerstalker on the trail of footnotes that would enable me to know which of those two things was right, not just because it's interesting in itself, but also because, obviously, where you situate Lincoln as a man who belongs to the ages, that is, to the long horizontal reach of history where we're judged by what is to come, or to the angels, that is, to the vertical verdict of heaven, whether he belongs to heaven or history, in other words, changes and determines and shapes your picture of who Lincoln is and what he did.
And Darwin, how did you come to Darwin?
My mom. This book is dedicated to my parents, but my mom is a scientist who did a lot of work in the genetic basis of linguistics, and she's always been a passionate Darwinian, lover of Darwin, and because of that, of course, I held it off for as long as I could. Finally, I sat down on a beach one day. You know how it is. Every summer, there's a pile of books that you're determined to get through. I think it's exactly the same pile. They probably get passed around like Christmas fruitcakes. It's Paradise Lost, War and Peace, The Man Without Qualities, and Proust, and get to through the last few volumes of Proust. You never do these things. Well, my summer thing is I'm going to read On the Origin of Species. So I took it out, and to my amazement discovered that not only is it a great book, but it's a great book. It's a terrific book to read, and I found myself turning the pages on the beach and thinking, wow, why didn't anyone ever tell me how interesting, how persuasive, how well-paced, how exciting this book is? It changes your view of the world. So that was when I first was stirred by Darwin, and I went on to read as much of Darwin in the original, so to speak, as I possibly could. The reading Darwin on the beach on Long Island took place 20-some years ago. That was a transformative experience, but we were in sharing a house in the terrible way New Yorkers do with about 24 other people in a three-bedroom apartment and house in Sag Harbor. But the nice thing is those things stay with you, and it's one of those, and it become the preoccupations become passions, and passions become obsessions. And when it reaches the point of obsession, I go to my editor and say, I am really obsessed with Darwin, or I am really obsessed with Van Gogh, and is there any occasion where I could write something about it? And then the editor, if it strikes him as something that would interest our readers, says, let me see. And then there almost always is an occasion, and then I write to the occasion.
Do they actually say, okay, Adam, you have to have X number of words by this point, or you need a long article by that point? I mean, what kind of strictures do you have in your writing?
I'm surrounded by strictures, and from inside, I feel like I'm a serf on a big plantation or big farm. I mean, I'll say I want to do Darwin, and then it's, can you get it in, 3 weeks or a month or something? And then, as happens inevitably to all of us, the deadline creeps up, and you find yourself writing all night to try and get it in. The New Yorker is a strange place because with all of the changes and transformations it's been through in the almost quarter century that I've been there, its core DNA is that it's both a literary magazine and a weekly magazine. And its weekly demands are, in a sense, as strong as its literary demands as its demands for style. So you're constantly negotiating between those two things.
Adam Gopnik, getting back to Darwin, our knowledge of Darwin sifts through kind of the mainstream, and what we get are, in a sense, rumors, not the original. I guess this may be true for Lincoln. Mm-hmm. It's probably true for anything in history. But I didn't know. Other friend of mine said, oh, yeah, of course, that Darwin used the word natural selection, did not say survival of the fittest, which means that social Darwinism, in a sense, isn't Darwinism.
Social Darwinism is not Darwinism. That's a very long and tricky story. And, you know, interestingly, in the first draft of this book, I had a long section about social Darwinism, but it really didn't belong in this book, which is not a history of Darwinism, but a meditation on Darwin's language. But the reality is that the idea of the survival of the fittest is an idea that Herbert Spencer first came up with, and it's a kind of, what shall we call it, a right-wing extrapolation of certain themes in Darwin in a direction that Spencer wanted to take it. The odd thing is that you could read Darwin, you could read On the Origin of Species, sort of in any political spirit you wanted. As you probably know, Karl Marx adored Darwin. Karl Marx saw himself as doing for human society what Darwin had done for the history of life. So he wanted to be the next Darwin. Spencer saw it in what we would now think of as a right-wing way. Liberals saw it in a liberal sense. So you can use Darwin ideologically any way you want, but Darwin himself, in his own writings and in his own beliefs, was never sympathetic with what we now call social Darwinism or eugenics, very much and radically the opposite. He was a staunch abolitionist. The whole central idea, which is a new book that makes much of in Darwin's work, and it's quite true, is that mankind is one. If you don't have that notion that all of the human race is one thing, then you can't have the idea that we all descend from one ancestor.
The idea of natural selection itself seems to come from his looking at pigeons and at dogs and saying, okay, this is man-made selection, and then making the jump to natural selection. And survival of the fittest came from Wallace?
Wallace liked the term because he thought that natural selection didn't make clear enough what the mechanism was that allowed it to happen. He thought it made it sound too much as though there were a divine chooser who was picking out. So he thought survival of the fittest was stronger. But Darwin, in an interesting letter, rejects that idea. He says it has just too many... Darwin was an extremely polite man. He was an Englishman, and he behaved as Englishmen do, with full of embarrassment and reticence. But he made it plain that it was too loaded a phrase for him. He didn't want it, because the crucial thing that he wanted to emphasize, just as you say, is that natural selection is simply exactly what we're seeing when we have artificial selection, that people and monkeys and apes and everything else that we see has evolved through this process of natural selection in the same way that wolves have turned into Pekingese. And that was the analogy he wanted to keep in people's minds.
It's kind of a subtext to the role that religion and fundamentalism plays in Angels and Ages, because, you know, the Christian right has accepted Lincoln, though he was more most of his life a deist rather than specifically Christian.
If that. There's a lot of evidence that he was an outright free thinker and atheist early on.
As was Darwin.
Towards the end, yes.
Going along with the survival of the fittest, I always find it strange that the fundamentalists who claim to be talking about love, even in that area, survival of the fittest is the nastiest way to look at what's going on this planet.
Yes, it emphasizes the struggle, which is there. The struggle for existence is a term that Darwin liked. And it doesn't emphasize the harmony and the beauty of all of these forms, which Darwin at the end of On the Origin of Species does. He talks about the beauty of this view of life, which can enable you to understand how the most complicated things in all of creation could have slowly evolved from smaller ones. It's funny because Lincoln has been, I think, misunderstood and misappropriated. But Darwin remains a source of enormous resistance, and it's a strange thing. The last chapter of this book, of Angels and Ages, attempts to struggle with that. Why should it be that this incontrovertible truth of biology, it's as well-established a theory as any in the history of science, why should it be still so troubling to so many people of faith, as they describe themselves?
Back 150 years ago, when Origin of the Species came out, it was not rejected by Christianity.
Yes, exactly so. One of the first signed copies, I suspect it was the first signed copy, that Darwin sent out of the book was to Charles Kingsley, who was Queen Victoria's chaplain. Very weird guy. He wrote a children's classic called The Water Babies, which is very hard to read now, but a very good book. He was bizarre. He sent Darwin a letter once saying that he had figured out the origin of religion. It was because the functions of elimination and the functions of reproduction in human beings were so close together. He said so that our source of pleasure and our source of shame are unified. Very Freudian idea. Anyway, Darwin sent the book to Kingsley, and Kingsley incorporated Darwin into The Water Babies, which is a kind of Christian allegory. And basically what Kingsley and people like him thought was, look, Darwin is the Newton of biology. Just the way Newton showed how beautifully designed the universe had been by God, with what regularity and elegance, Darwin shows with what regularity and elegance the natural world has been ordered by God. So the first reaction to Origen was not simply, oh my God, it's the end of religion. It was much more varied and multi-part than that.
You're listening to an interview with Adam Gopnik, whose latest book is Angels and Ages. Adam Gopnik, when you're doing your research, particularly for trying to find the connections, what did you find out along the way that which was kind of like a eureka moment about either of these guys that you just didn't know?
There's one moment, there are sort of two moments where the sort of the wires cross and they touch. Again, I'm obviously want to always clarify that this isn't meant to be a comparison of the two men. It's an essay on the origins of the liberal mind, in a sense, the modern mind. But there is a wonderful moment that I was unprepared for when Darwin is writing to an American friend at the height of the Civil War, the beginning of the Civil War, and he is talking about it, and he says, you know, I don't recall the exact words, Richard, but he says, in effect, the whole future of the democratic ideal depends on the outcome of this struggle. And that was the way many liberal Englishmen saw it, liberal and radical Englishmen saw it, not because they cared so much about the American Union, but because they understood that the classic complaint about democracy was that it was self, not just self-defeating, but self-destroying, self-annihilating. Think of the example of the French Revolution, for instance. So they knew that if the North was defeated, then the take on it would be, oh, you see, it's as we always said, those democracies last for 50 years and then they're gone, they vanish. So hope for democratic reform in England rested very literally on the success of the North in the Civil War. And I was stunned to see that Darwin was that engaged in a struggle that remote from his immediate concerns.
Do you think Lincoln ever read Darwin?
I'm almost certain not. Lincoln read earlier a kind of proto-evolutionary book by a guy named Chambers, which Darwin read as well. And it was sort of the very rough poetic draft of an idea of evolution. Darwin was interested in it but had a certain contempt for it because it had no facts. It had no empirical basis. Lincoln read it, this is in the 1830s, and was hugely, according to his best friend and partner Herndon, transformed by it. It's one of the things that pushed him towards atheism and free thinking. No, I don't think Lincoln ever did read Darwin. Remember, when Origen comes out, it's in 1859, and by that point, Lincoln's passion, so to speak, has begun.
Well, the Beagle book came out years before, though.
Yes, that's true. I don't think, there's no evidence that he read it. Lincoln was a voracious reader. He was a man of the word, and it's conceivable. But I wouldn't pretend that I could either prove or even suspect that it's so.
A couple of things. You mentioned before problems with Godwin's book, and I guess you mean the idea of the team of rivals?
Yes, it's a wonderful book, and if you have it on an airplane and you have 6.5 hours, my God, you're grateful for it because the pages turn and the characters are beautifully drawn, and I learned a lot from every page. But I do think that we can, and it has some political relevance right now. I think John Stauffer wrote something about this somewhere. You know, what made Lincoln remarkable was not that he was a conciliatory figure. It was standard practice for every politician in the 19th century to bring their rivals into their cabinet. Gladstone did it, and all the French presidents in the 1870s did it. What was remarkable about Lincoln was that he wasn't a conciliator anymore. He said, remember, that's what had been the whole history of the country on the issue of slavery up until Lincoln's election. And the South secedes not as part of some independent process, to which the election of Lincoln is incidental. The South secedes because Lincoln has just been elected, and they recognize that though he may be temporizing, the party that he speaks for, the early Republican Party, is in effect an abolitionist party. And Lincoln had said, plain as day, this country cannot survive half slave and half free. It will become all one or all the other, and there was no ambiguity about which one he thought it should be. So it seems to me that what's remarkable about Lincoln, and then that's how the war starts. He says, you fire on the fort, and we go to war, is that Lincoln was the man who said finally at the end, no, He said, we cannot just go on giving you, that is to say the slaveholding South, whatever you want whenever you demand it, because otherwise you'll get out of the Union. You're not going out of the Union. We have a contract. You're a signed party to it. We're a signed party to it. You can't get out, and you can't pretend that we don't have a right to comment and legislate about the future of slavery. Now, it should be said, because it's an important part of the history, that in the first inaugural address, Lincoln did seem to hold out the possibility of guaranteeing the existence of slavery in the South if the South would stay in the Union. That seems to have been something he did under the pressure of those very rivals that he brought into his cabinet. So, no pretending, there's not a lot of back and forth in Lincoln's position on it. That's true. But on the whole, basically, Lincoln was a man of iron. He was a man of iron conviction. He was not a man who bent with the wind and tried desperately and always to placate his opposition.
Do you think that the Obama cabinet with Hillary Clinton and what the media is playing here is just media hype then?
No, I think Obama probably was influenced by the book, and I think Obama is clearly a conciliatory politician who genuinely and intelligently wants to bring in a broad range of people. No, my point is just that if you want the example of Lincoln, then the real example is there are principles you can't negate and there are lines you can't cross, and that finally, this is what Lincoln is all about, confrontation becomes necessary and inevitable. Now, we could argue forever about whether confrontation is necessary and inevitable in a particular situation, but you can't point to Lincoln and say, follow Lincoln and avoid confrontation. That's exactly the direct reverse of what Lincoln was about.
Adam Gopnik, in writing the book and trying to pull it all together as a book, was there a temptation to dig too deeply into contemporary thought and compare and contrast?
You know, I'm the last one to be able to judge how well it's done. I didn't want to do that. I wanted this to be an essay that would do two things, a book that would do two things. One, I wanted it to be about these two guys because there's been a ton of scholarship and study of these two guys in recent years. And I wanted to kind of synthesize it. I wanted to give you a sort of, I hope not a Cliff's Notes version of it, but a compact version of it, where you could learn. Very few people know about the death of Darwin's daughter or know about Lincoln's relationship to Shakespeare, for instance. And those were Lincoln as a lawyer. I wanted to be able to offer kind of brief lives of both these guys. But more even than that, I wanted to write about them as writers. And so I wanted to steer clear as much as I could of obvious contemporary parallels or obvious contemporary problems. So Obama's name, for instance, isn't mentioned anywhere in the book, although as I was writing this book, obviously it was during the rise of Obama. And obviously, like anyone, I was interested in the way that this eloquence of explanation that I was writing about and that I was clearly, in a sense, proselytizing for in this book was suddenly and surprisingly being exemplified by this new figure. But I curbed my tongue and I held my pen back and I did not write about it because I didn't want to make the book contemporary in a facile way, and I didn't want to date it immediately because 4 years from now when Obama is Jimmy Carter, God forbid, but might be, I didn't want the book to be vitiated by that.
I wrote a question down, and then I realized I knew the answer. Do you identify more with Darwin or Lincoln? And then I realized in thinking about it that Lincoln's still very opaque, whereas Darwin is not. I think it's impossible to really identify with Lincoln that way.
I think so, too. Now, I don't want to I obviously identify more with Darwin. I don't want to over-identify with Darwin because one of the things we have to remember is that Darwin on the page and in biography and in his memoirs is a hugely appealing guy. He's a devoted father, loving husband, many good friend. But he's also, we have to remember, an Englishman. An Englishman's closure, an Englishman's embarrassment. And I think that side of Darwin, that opacity in Darwin is easy to overlook, and we don't want to sentimentalize it. Lincoln is a fundamentally opaque character, as he knew himself, partly because he was a man of limitless shrewdness, and as Obama is, I think, and he had to be different things to different people. And also because, let's remember, even as we admire Lincoln for his genius as a writer, for his rightness on certain issues, Lincoln was a killer in plain English. Lincoln was the executor of what was until then probably the bloodiest war in history. And Lincoln, there was something noble in Lincoln because he didn't run away from that reality. He knew what he was responsible for. He knew how much blood was on his hands, and he thought that blood was necessary. But the fact remains that Lincoln was a commander-in-chief in an incredibly bloody war, and I think anybody who too easily identifies with Lincoln is evading the fundamental reality of who Lincoln was and what he did.
Adam Gopnik, I read your previous book, Through the Children's Gate, Write a Home in New York, which is, in a sense, a sequel to Paris to the Moon, what it was like coming back to New York in 2000 over the next 5 years. And then I read Angels and Ages. And, of course, there aren't specific connections. One is about your life and the life of the city, and the other is this essay. But what I noticed from the continuity from Paris to the Moon through the novel and then these is that you seem to be becoming more interested in certain philosophical issues, moving almost away from observation towards something else. Do you think that's true?
That's a very interesting observation. I hadn't thought about it in a self-conscious way, really. I think that there is something in that. That is to say that Through the Children's Gate is meant to be a funny book, and it's meant to be a book of family stories. But it's also, I think, it ended up being a bit of a kind of first draft meditation on liberal civilization. What do we mean by bourgeois civilization, if you like, that kind of middle-class, urban, democratically-minded, family-centered civilization that began sometime in the 19th century and persists to this day. And I was forced to confront it and meditate on it because the central event in Through the Children's Gate is 9/11. That seemed to be a moment of maximum terror and threat and so on. In retrospect, probably, I don't want to say exaggerated, but less central maybe than we thought at the time. In any case, I was naturally led to that kind of reflection. And yes, I think it's true that there is a sense, I had not thought about this, so I'm groping for words as I find them, but I do think it's true that the central subject of Angels and Ages is that same civilization, the origins of that civilization, bourgeois civilization, you want to call it that, liberal civilization. And one of the questions it raises is what does it give us and what does it take away from us? And it clearly gives us a lot. It gives us science. It gives us democracy. It takes away from us easy consolation. It narrows our world. It's certainly true about both Darwin and Lincoln. They were family men in the good sense, that they genuinely loved their children in a way that wouldn't have been the case 100 years before. But they also were focused on their own littler worlds in some respects. So I think in that sense that if one wants to say that both of these books are charting the accounting, the losses and gains, the credits and debits of a life lived within liberal civilization at its beginnings in the 19th century, in its decadence, if you like, right now. Yes, I think that's true.
I also go with the idea that you're dealing with, if you want to call it the word community, how we function as a community as well. There's a lot, of course, from Darwin on that as well as Lincoln and Through the Children's Gate. And I wonder how much that comes from the fact that we spent 8 years in a bubble where community was dismissed.
Yes, absolutely. Certainly, though, Through the Children's Gate was not meant to be an overtly political book. One of the things it was about how in a state of maximum and, in retrospect and at the time, manipulated fear. How do you choose your hopes and your lives over your fears? And in the same way, that's one of the things that Angels and Ages is about. It's about how do you reach out? How do you create a community? That's one of the things Darwin was trying to do. And he was scared. He waited for 20 years in part because he thought, I don't need this grief. I don't need this problem. And how do you create a community of readers? How do you create a community of like-minded people? And one of the ways, now obviously I will think this because I'm a writer, is you do it with language. You find ways to make new words and new sentences that speak to new communities. And I think that one of the things, I don't want to put this in too grandiose a way, Richard, but if I were in a grandiose state of mind, if I had taken the right set of drugs, I'd be inclined to say that it's very much about the thing that interests me in Darwin and Lincoln is about how you vindicate speech, how you vindicate truth-telling, how you vindicate argument in a time after it's been diminished and degraded for so many years.
At a certain point, and I'm not sure when it was, but it was fairly early on. It may have even been before 9/11, but it was probably right after. I realized there was absolutely no point in listening to any speeches from the Bush administration because there was no connection whatsoever between words and actions.
No connection between words and facts, words and objects, words and deeds. It's simply we were in a world where there was a connection between sort of the reflexes of fear and the utterances of anxiety. And that was the world we were in. Having said that, does it mean that if we can speak with more inspiration, argue more eloquently, that our problems will be solved? That would be foolish to believe. But, you know, for me, the great Obama speech, and I say I rigorously kept Obama out of this book, but inevitably, for me, as for everyone, it's the natural extrapolation of it. For me, the great Obama speech was not "Yes, we can" with the guitars or any of those things. It was the speech he gave on race in Philadelphia. And when he was able to articulate a very subtle and nuanced argument about the nature of American racism, the experience of the black community, and then extend it to say, you know, if you really make an effort, you can see that that's how the extremes of the white community see us in turn. Boy, that was a complicated, multi-part, patient teasing out of a torturous issue. And I thought when it was done, I thought, oh, it's a great speech, but he's screwed. He can't survive that. That's not the way the world works. It'll be broken up into like sausage into tiny little sound bites and taken apart. And amazingly, that's not what happened. A fair number of people, a majority of Americans said, that makes some sense. That guy, what that guy is saying is persuasive to me. That, for me, was the great moment. And that's something that speaks exactly to the tradition of Lincoln and Darwin that I'm trying to write about. And if there's cause for hope, that's it.
A number of books are coming out right now about the Civil War and about Lincoln. These books were in the chute for a long time, meaning that it was long before the Obama connection was made that these people began writing these books. Do you think it's just some kind of coincidence that suddenly everybody is fixated on the Civil War, at least the publishers?
Civil War books sell. And that's publishers' concern number one. So there's a kind of built-in audience for it, and I think that's a large part of the mechanism of that. The bicentennial is upon us. That's another part of it. And certainly I think that, you know, books are on, you're right, are on long shoots, but they're not on endlessly long shoots. And I'm sure a lot of people had books that could have come out later this year or next year that were rushed to come out now. You know, the Civil War is obviously the great divider in American history. And one of the things that astonishes me about it still, and I write about this a little bit in the book, I was a kid in Philadelphia back in the 1960s. And in fourth grade, fifth grade, we would study the Civil War. And it was still being taught then, Richard, as a tragic struggle between two good sides. That was essentially the way it was taught. The North was the right side, but you could certainly have enormous sympathy with Southerners defending their honor and their country. And slavery, the horror of slavery, the reality of slavery, the existence of a kind of concentration camp culture, that was all kind of glossed over. And the abolitionists on one side and the secessionists on the other side were both unfortunate fanatics. That account of the Civil War, which lasted for a very long time and has historical causes of its own, that seems now to be largely over. I think that more and more, I don't mean the, you know, in the recreators, the people who get dressed up in right. Confederate uniforms, but I think that average Americans now recognize not just the wrong, but the horror of slavery. And I think that in a funny way, we're able then to deal with the Civil War as it actually was. As in Drew Faust's book, This Republic of Suffering, which came out last year, and which I reference in this book, we have a sense of the sheer horror of the Civil War, of just how bloody and cruel a struggle it was. It was a struggle without a bit of gallantry or a bit of glory on either side. And I think as a realistic view of the Civil War comes home, we see a whole new literature that exemplifies that.
There's a place where you talk about pretty much just groups of men with muskets just walking toward each other, firing. It's kind of a suicidal...
As close as you and I are right now, and they would point and fire. And let's not forget, too, that there was a policy on the part of the South of massacring any black troops that appeared. Right? Remember, there were black regiments raised. Oh, that's another interesting thing. You asked before, was there anything that stunned me about Darwin? And it was exactly that Colonel Higginson, the patron of Emily Dickinson, who was also one of those heroic men who raised a regiment of black troops along with Robert Shaw, went to visit Darwin in England after the Civil War. And Darwin hated getting visitors. It was a big nuisance for him. And then only after did Darwin realize who Higginson was and what he had done. And he wrote him an apologetic letter saying, if I had only known that you were the man, the colonel, who raised those troops, I would have wrung you by the hand and welcomed you to my home because what you did was so heroic and so amazing. And my wife and I have read about you and so on. It's a lovely thing because clearly Darwin at the time was just sort of burying his head and, oh, my God, one more American. And only afterwards did he realize that his great cause, abolition, was Darwin's great cause, too.
A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Stephen Johnson about his book, The Invention of Air.
About Priestley,
and suddenly I'm coming on this, and the Wedgwood connection they were kind of related.
They were directly related. There's a wonderful book, which I'm sure you've read, Jenny Uglow's book, The Lunar Men, one of the really wonderful books of the last few years, which is about the circle of the Darwins, the grandfathers, Darwin, Wedgwood, Priestley. And they were a kind of a funny little collection of political radicals and early industrialists with that odd double consciousness, because they brutally exploited their workers and at the same time they fought for freedom of the slaves and for all the and for democracy. It's a contradictory, like all lives are contradictory. But yes, Priestley was right at the center of it. Gets driven from his home in the north of England and sets sail for America and then later for France. And so there's a direct connection between that circle, the circle of Priestley, and Darwin later on. But it's exactly, that's exactly the point. Until that moment, until this crucial moment in the middle of the 19th century, those moments when democracy and science intertwine are like little flare-ups in a great darkness. They flare up and then they go out. They're put out either by tyranny or they go out because of their own lack of fuel. And it's only really in this moment that I'm writing about, in the time of Darwin and Lincoln, the 1860s, that the thing catches fire and stays lit. And that's, in a sense, I hadn't thought of it, is really what this book is about. Why wasn't this another flare? Why was it a fire that continues to burn?
Adam Gopnik, switching subjects for a moment, you have very successful siblings. How were you raised in such a way that, you know, you get a couple of scientists and a New Yorker writer? What was
and
your...
art critic and a public health activist. This book is dedicated to my mother and father, Erwin and Myrna. You know, it's always hard. You neither want to sentimentalize your own upbringing nor be too stern about it. You have both inclinations as a child. But in plain English, we were brought up around books. We were just brought up around books and brought up believing what I think is true, that no book should be inaccessible to a child and no book is inaccessible to a child, that you can read anything. And I passionately believe that the more you give your kids to read, the more kids read before their adolescence, the more they'll be at home for the rest of their lives with ideas, with history. They'll see it not as some painful thing that lies outside their experience, but they'll see it as a familiar thing that's at the heart of their experience. You know, I can be foolish in that regard, but I read The Great Gatsby to my two kids last summer. But my God, they loved it. They got it. It's a fairy tale that they could absorb. So the blessing of my upbringing, apart from all the other blessings of love and food and conversation, was the blessing of books.
Do Luke and Olivia read?
Olivia, my little one, is a fabulous reader. Beautiful, strange silence that falls over a house when a child is reading. You say, I haven't heard from Olivia in the last half hour. And you know that if you sneak up, she's on her bed turning the pages of Aragon or Cornelia Funke or whatever it is she's reading now. Luca, my older boy, is a very good reader when he reads, but he is, like every child of his generation, permanently attached to his computer with his headphones on, listening to iTunes and IMing with his friends. And the beautiful thing about that is, I think, that where 25 years ago people all said, the written word is disappearing. Nobody will ever care about it. We live in a society of images. Well, his generation of kids live by the written word. They live by the written word not in the way maybe you and I live by it, that is in books and essays. They live by it in short bursts of instant messages and email. Blogs, but they Facebook pages, but they live by the written word.
Have you noticed, by the way, that our generation suddenly discovered Facebook this year?
Yes, I have resisted Facebook completely. I think there's something anyone over 40 on Facebook is in a tenuous, precarious emotional position. But it is true. At some point, you know, I really believe that new literary sensibility will leap over and become a new kind of writing. You'll find it in a new kind of novel and so on. But the funny thing is also about it is that we, this happened too late to put in through the children's gate, but it's a story that belongs there. You see your kid attached to his computer every day as to an umbilical cord with his headphones on, and you actually find yourself saying, please, could you get away from the computer and come watch television with the family?
Does Olivia ever talk about Charlie Ravioli, or is that ancient history?
It's the legendary Charlie Ravioli, her imaginary friend who was always too busy to play with her because she was growing up in New York. No, you know, she was 3 and 4 when Charlie was part of her life. And people ask her about it, and she has the same sort of, well, that was, you know, so many centuries ago that happened to me. So it doesn't play part of her life, though she remembers him and she season, but you know how it is when you're a child. The space between 3 or 4 and 9 is like the space between BC and AD.
This is a guy who she invents an imaginary play friend who's too busy and has an assistant call to say he's too busy.
He has an assistant. And what she was doing, Chris, is, you know, and we were talking about my siblings. My sister Allison, of course, is a psychologist, and she makes a cameo appearance in that piece, a child psychologist particularly. And that's what kids always do. They look at their experience, and they make little stories out of their experience. Olivia was growing up in New York with two very harried and busy parents who were constantly leaving each other messages and sending each other texts and getting a call from somebody's assistant, so-and-so is on the phone, wants to speak to you, and so on. And so she, with great wit, turned that into her own little Prince of Our Disorder, Charlie Ravioli.
Adam Gopnik, have you begun thinking about another book, or...?
I have another book that is almost finished that I actually have to finish in the next few days, and it is another book for kids. It's whatever those books are. It's a kind of fantasy for adults of any condition, any size. And it's a kind of sequel to my last one, The King in the Window, but it's set in New York, and it has a completely different set of rules in a whole new universe, and it's about a little girl rather than a little boy. It's a book I've written with Olivia and around her experience in lots of ways. I focus grouped it on her second grade class. That book is called The Steps Across the Water, and Bruce McCall, the wonderful New Yorker artist, is lavishly illustrating it, and we hope to have it out next Christmas. And then at some point I want to write a book, and that's a kind of prequel, God help me, to Through the Children's Gate, which is about arriving in New York. It's about that experience that many of us went through where you got on a bus one day when you were 20 years old, said New York City. And then you found yourself living in a basement with cockroaches for the next 3 years.
There was a Broadway show a few years ago called The Life. I don't know if you've ever
heard of it. No, I didn't.
Oh, it was a Cy Coleman show and came out in the 90s when Times Square was already changing. And it was about, you know, 15 to 20 years earlier when you came to New York about what it was like to be in Times Square. You might want to check that out.
Oh, that sounds good. Well, you know, that's the other thing I'm working on is a musical comedy. I'm working with the wonderful composer David Shire. And working on it. Yeah, we're working on an adaptation of Through the Children's Gate, much transformed, certain characters and scenes, situations from it, about a New York family.
You've been listening to an interview with Adam Gopnik, whose latest book is Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.